The story of Heisman Trophy winner Niall Kinnick gets told a lot, an outstanding young athlete who died before his time. But the very first winner of the Heisman Trophy was also from Iowa. Today, his story. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Jay Berwanger was the son of a blacksmith from Dubuque, and he almost didn't go to college. But he did and became the greatest college athlete of his day. I'll talk with Brian Cooper about his new biography of Berwanger. Then I'll talk with cellist Tony Arnone about his series of solo concerts in unexpected places. We're going Bach to work today. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last week on this program, we spent an hour talking about some of the most storied athletes in Iowa history. But we didn't talk about one of the most gifted football players to ever hail from the state of Iowa. Jay Berwanger was the son of a blacksmith in Dubuque who became the greatest college athlete of his day. And he also became the very first winner of the Heisman Trophy. With me today is Brian Cooper. He is author of First Heisman, The Life of Jay Berwanger. Hello, Brian.
Morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, my pleasure.
And in your book, you introduce readers to Jay just as he makes his first touchdown of his varsity football career. You write about it in the prologue of the book, and I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The score was only 6-0, but the way Washington High dominated Dubuque all afternoon, the margin might have seemed like 60-0. With only 5 minutes of the 1929 season opener remaining, Dubuque had not come close to scoring, while the hosts from Cedar Rapids seemed capable of advancing the ball at will. Yet, somehow, Dubuque managed to rebuff all but one of Washington's touchdown drives. Watching nervously from the Dubuque sideline was John Berwanger. The sophomore had yet to play a down, and the way this game was going, he doubted that he would. However, Dubuque blocked a Washington punt, recovered the ball on the host's 27-yard line, and started to drive. As the red and blue approached the Washington end zone, coach Wilbur Dalzell suddenly called the 15-year-old's name. He ordered Berwanger to replace John Morris as running back. The boy was so nervous that he could barely speak his name when, as required by the substitution rules of the day, he reported to the official. He looked toward his opponents. Quote, "From the bench, the Cedar Rapids boys had been the size of houses," he recalled, "and I was afraid my heart could not stand a close-up view." He was so scared of the view, in fact, that he couldn't bear to watch the very game that he was about to change. Berwanger had barely joined the Dubuque huddle when he heard his number called. He received the ball, cradled it in both arms, and headed toward the gap off right tackle. He didn't see what happened next for one simple reason. He had closed his eyes. Nonetheless, he crashed through the line for healthy gain. Dalzell's troops ran the play again, and again the eyes-closed Berwanger chewed up more yardage. The game clock continued to run. Dubuque ran the play a third straight time, and for the third straight play, Berwanger took the ball, closed his eyes, and charged forward. "I never once saw a chalk mark or the hole I was supposed to hit or a Cedar Rapids tackler," Berwanger said a few years later. "When my hands closed on the ball, my eyes would shut tightly and I would just run." He wound up on the ground, still clutching the ball and squeezing his eyes shut. The excited shouts of his teammates brought things into focus for him. "I opened my eyes then, and sure enough, there were the goalposts right in front of me," Berwanger said. "That was my first touchdown. I'll never forget it." That touchdown was the first of many by a player whose name will forever be associated with the most recognized award in American sports, the Heisman Trophy.
That's Brian Cooper reading from his book, First Heisman, The Life of Jay Berwanger. So he made that first touchdown of his varsity career, and he never even saw it.
He never saw it. He didn't open his eyes until his teammates were picking him up off the ground.
When did you first find out about Jay?
Well, I've been in Dubuque 27 years here. I'm editor of the Telegraph Herald, and had heard Jay Berwanger's name mentioned now and then, usually in early December when the Heisman Trophy winner was announced, and the papers would run the list of previous winners, and there at the top of the list, 1935, was Jay Berwanger, and people would say, you know, he's from Dubuque, and okay. And that was really my first awareness of Jay Berwanger and his connection to Dubuque.
And what made you want to know more?
I had started looking into some personal writing projects. I've done a couple of baseball biographies, and I wanted to do a project that included or that featured someone from this immediate area, from the Dubuque area. And I did some checking around and was astounded that no one yet had written a full biography of Jay Berwanger. And between Jay's Dubuque connections and his career and business life in Chicago, it made it really a natural for me to pursue this one.
And you actually went back and you researched pretty much every football game that he ever played.
I went through all of his football games in high school and in college, and using the newspaper microfilm here in Dubuque and Chicago Public Library, University of Chicago Library, and was able to piece together his career fairly well through high school and in college. The sports writing of the day was a little different, so sometimes it's a little hard to understand some of the quirks of the game back then. But I was able to put together his football career, and he also was involved in wrestling and track, and as best I could piece together his career in those sports as well.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning. He is from Dubuque, Iowa. Tell me a little bit about his family.
Well, his family has their German descendants. His father was born in Dubuque, just barely. His mother was about 8 3/4 months pregnant when they came over from Germany. Jay's father was born here in Dubuque just literally weeks after the family arrived. Jay's mother was born in Germany and came over in the 1880s. His parents married around 1912, and Jay's mother was from Chicago, and his father was from Dubuque, born in Dubuque. And the family settled into a North End home in Dubuque and started their lives here. And Jay was born not quite 100 years ago now, in March of 1914. Jay's father was a blacksmith. He also had a small farm, and so his father kept really busy, and Jay grew up along with his siblings having lots of responsibilities on the farm.
And this, of course, was, as you mentioned, 1914 was when he was born, so he lived through World War I in Dubuque, which was a difficult time to be someone with German heritage anywhere, and in Iowa. Was that hard for the family?
Well, I don't know if it affected the family directly, but it is true that things did change in the U.S., in Iowa, and in Dubuque. Dubuque still had public schools that taught classes entirely in German. Not German classes, but all the classes, reading and math and so on, were all taught in German. And those were outlawed by the state of Iowa as World War I was heating up. And so I'm sure that the Berwangers, like many German families of German descent, did feel the impact. So it it was a difficult time for lots of families, and I'm sure the Berwangers were part of that.
You write about his school career that he, in his early years, did not impress his teachers with his scholarship or his behavior, but he did start to impress a lot of people with his athletic abilities. When did he first start showing promise?
Well, he showed some promise when he was in the middle school years, playing some football for Jefferson Junior High, but he really was not that big or that dominant, but his speed certainly was impressive, and he played end on the junior high football team. Then he moved over to Dubuque Senior High, and that was a three-year school at the time, and did make the varsity as a sophomore, but as I indicated in the prologue, didn't start his first game. His coach, Wilbur Dalzell, was not one to make, as he called it, overnight heroes. So he expected Jay to learn the fundamentals and to pay his dues and not be a starter right away. But he really came into his own really as a senior in high school. As a junior, Jay made honorable mention on the all-state team that the Des Moines Register and Tribune maintained, but honorable mention followed the top five. So Jay didn't even make the top five all-state teams at running back as a junior, but he grew physically and I think in his maturity by his senior year. And after his senior season, not only did he make the all-state team, he was named the captain of the all-state team for the 1931 season.
But in high school, football was not his only sport. He also wrestled and he also ran track. Was he also as gifted in those sports?
Well, he did qualify for the state meets in all in wrestling and in track. The wrestling season was pretty abbreviated, but he did make the state tournament after a few matches. And then he was a gifted track athlete as well, multi-event athlete. He did well in the hurdles and dashes and the field events, and actually up until the very last had aspired to make the U.S. Olympic team in 1936 as he was finishing up at Chicago. But he entered college with the goal of making the U.S. Olympic team. So he was really an all-purpose athlete and actually told his family that he liked wrestling more than football. But obviously football is what brought him the most recognition.
Right. Well, we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking about Jay Berwanger, who was the very first recipient of the Heisman Trophy. He was from Dubuque, Iowa. And I'm talking today with Brian Cooper, who is author of the new book, First Heisman, The Life of Jay Berwanger. He's also editor of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to go Bach to work with cellist Tony Arnone. But right now, we're talking about the very first winner of the Heisman Trophy. He was from Dubuque, Iowa, and there's a new biography of him that's just been released. It's called First Heisman, The Life of Jay Berwanger. And with me today is the author of that book, Brian Cooper. So, Brian, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Jay's high school career. And, of course, he was a real standout in his senior year of playing football, but he also competed in a number of other sports. You just mentioned that he said that wrestling was his favorite. And you also point out that at some point in Iowa, there was a moment when a future Heisman Trophy winner wrestled a future Nobel Prize winner.
Well, they didn't actually wrestle each other,
oh,
but they
okay.
did. They were both involved in the same meet. So, the it was probably the only time we had a two noted athletes of that stature, a Nobel Prize winner, and also the first Heisman Trophy winner involved in the same card.
Right, and of course that was a young Norman Borlaug that we're talking
about.
So he performed so well in high school, and of course even back then, great athletes were heavily courted. Who tried to get him to come play college ball?
Well, about half the Big Ten schools made some contact to try to woo Berwanger to their campuses. The University of Chicago was a member of the Big Ten at that time, was a charter member of the Big Ten Conference, and there was a gentleman in Dubuque by the name of Ira Davenport, who was a Chicago alum. He ran Dubuque Boat and Boiler Works, and was a track Olympian in 1912, won the bronze medal at 800 meters. And he became Berwanger's mentor of sorts and was really one who encouraged Berwanger to consider the decathlon for an Olympic bid. Chicago really had the inside track because of Ira Davenport's connection. But there were several Big Ten schools that did try to recruit him, but Chicago won out.
Including the University of Iowa.
University of Iowa. The Iowa coach made a tactical mistake. He came to the Dubuque Senior High Awards banquet as the guest speaker and told the audience that any boy who would cross the state lines to attend college would be a traitor to the state of Iowa. And with Dubuque being a border community such as it is, that Berwanger said did not go over very well with the boys. And he said really none of his classmates went to Iowa to play football after that.
Well, and so the University of Chicago was attractive to him because of his connection with Ira Davenport. Probably his mother's connections to Chicago also made it attractive to him. But financially, it wasn't a great choice for him.
Well, the scholarship rules were a lot different then. But Berwanger won a full tuition scholarship. And the Big Ten didn't allow really much more than tuition at the time. And so Berwanger's full tuition scholarship to the University of Chicago was worth $300 a year. That's $100 per quarter. They were on the quarter system. So that was his scholarship. Berwanger still had to cover his own room and board, so he had to work. He worked in his fraternity house. He worked for the campus maintenance department in the hospital, and he even showed up in the locker room when there would be high school tournaments and such, and passed out gym towels. So he worked throughout in addition to playing football and being a member of the track team.
Now, the University of Chicago famously did away with varsity football just a few years after Berwanger graduated, although it did come back later on. Can you give me an idea of what kind of standing the University of Chicago had? I mean, it was a Big Ten school at the time. What did people think about this team back when Berwanger went there?
Well, University of Chicago football program was in a state of decline when Berwanger arrived. Early in the 20th century, Amos Alonzo Stagg was the coach, and Chicago was a national powerhouse, Big Ten champion several times, and they had done very well. But by the 20s, by the mid-20s, Chicago football was in decline. Berwanger arrived, and even with the best football player in the nation on the team, Chicago couldn't do any better than a 500 season each of the three varsity seasons where Berwanger played. And that included some easy non-conference victories early in the each season. So after Berwanger graduated, things just went downhill in a big hurry. Chicago only won one more Big Ten game in the next four seasons. And after the 1939 season, Chicago threw in the towel and dropped Big Ten football. And they stayed out of college football for the next 30 years. And when it did come back in 1969, it was as a Division III program. It was not pursuing any sort of a big-time program any longer.
Well, as you mentioned, it was a time of decline for the football team. It also became a time of transition when Berwanger arrived there. His freshman season was for the coach who had been the one and only head football coach at the University of Chicago up to that point, and then a new coach came in.
Right. Amos Alonzo Stagg was 40 years as the head football coach, and he was sent into forced retirement by the university, and they brought in a new coach, highly regarded Clark Shaughnessy. And Shaughnessy might have been the best thing that ever happened to Berwanger, because Shaughnessy was an offensive genius. He was well regarded throughout his career as being quite an innovator on offense. And Shaughnessy made the most of a fairly weak team with one superstar in Berwanger. And that ability to draw plays to help highlight Berwanger's skills really brought national attention to Berwanger and the Chicago program, and wound up bringing Berwanger that first Heisman Trophy.
I want to talk about Berwanger's number 99. How did he get that?
When Shaughnessy was passing out uniforms for Berwanger's sophomore season, he gave Berwanger number 99, and he said, "Well, best I can see, you are as close to a perfect 100 as I've ever seen, and so I can't give you number 100, but I can give you 99, and that number stuck with him. A few years later, Tommy Harmon for Michigan actually didn't want to do a 99, but he did do a 98. So some of those high numbers were popular back then. The rules have changed now, where numbers have to be allocated according to a position. But back then, he was the only number 99 out there.
That's a really unusual story. Not just it's a lot of fun, but for a coach to say that to a player who was only a sophomore, that just seems bizarre to me. It's hard to imagine a coach saying that to a sophomore player in any kind of situation today.
It really spoke to his innate ability as a football player, as an athlete, and really as a human being. He was, despite all of his success, he was very modest. He was very supportive of his teammates, and he just was the type of player that any coach would be thrilled to have. He was almost like an assistant coach out there, helping the team do its very best.
We're talking about the life of Jay Berwanger today. With me is Brian Cooper. He's author of a new biography, First Heisman, The Life of Jay Berwanger, who hailed from Dubuque, Iowa, and became the first winner of the Heisman Trophy. And there were other things about his college career that really made a mark on football, period, not just college football. And one of those things is that he ended up having a special helmet because he broke his nose twice. Tell me how that came about.
Right. Well, in his very last high school game, he suffered a broken nose when a Davenport player knocked into him or crashed into him while Berwanger was trying to field a punt. That was Berwanger continued the game and played throughout, but he did suffer a broken nose there. And then he suffered a broken nose in practices college freshman season. And the doctor said, if you have another broken nose, you're really you're going to have some serious problems lifelong. And the trainer for the Chicago team fashioned a face mask for Berwanger and as a way to protect his nose. And back in the day, face masks were pretty much non-existent. And to have a face guard, but also a vertical bar on your helmet to protect the nose was very unusual. So Berwanger was often the largest player on the field, even though he was running back. He was bigger than a lot of the linemen of the day. And then you put on this helmet with this foreboding face mask on. It was pretty intimidating for some of his opponents.
I'm sure, and he earned the nickname the Man in the Iron Mask because of it.
Right.
So
the Man in the Iron Mask.
Let's talk about his senior season at the University of Chicago. Obviously, that is the season that earned him that first Heisman Trophy. What are a couple of the highlights?
Well, he did play both ways, as a lot of players did it in the day, but he handled the offensive plays. He called the signals. He played defense. He handled all the punts, and he also handled all the kickoffs and the place kicks. Toward the end of the season, he had Chicago's playing Ohio State, and Chicago got off to a surprising 6-0 lead when Berwanger and Chicago was backed up on their own 15-yard line. Berwanger took the snap and then managed to weave his way through the entire Ohio State defense. Some players had two different shots at tackling him and missed both times. And Berwanger had an 85-yard touchdown that really captured a lot of attention. A lot of people would say that one run really was what sealed the deal for him to win the Heisman. A couple of weeks later, then he had probably a more spectacular run, but it was a punt return against the University of Illinois in his last college game. He returned the punt 49 yards. He got tripped up just at the 1-yard line and then scored the go-ahead touchdown and then kicked the extra point that gave
also
Chicago.
Kicked the extra point. That's so great.
So they won 7-6 in his very final, his very last college game.
He also once very famously tackled a Michigan player named Gerald Ford.
Right. When Berwanger was a junior and Jerry Ford was a senior, Ford was a center for Michigan and tried to tackle Berwanger, but Berwanger was so quick past him that all Ford got of Berwanger was the end of Berwanger's cleat against his cheek. Mm. It cut a gash into Jerry Ford's cheek. He left the game briefly for some stitches and came back in. But Ford, decades later, said that he would think of Jay Berwanger every single day when he looked in the mirror to shave and he could see that scar that he suffered in 1934.
Wow. Well, we only have just a few minutes left. And, of course, that senior season we've been talking about earned him so many awards. And the one that he was most proud of, actually, came from Chicago, a silver football, right?
Right. Back then, a Big Ten player aspired to win the Silver Football, which was the award for the most valuable player in the Big Ten. Some of the other awards were nice and so on, but if you played in the Big Ten, the Silver Football was the award back then, and Berwanger was fortunate enough to win that his senior season. He was All-American as a junior and a senior and won several other awards, some of which we hadn't heard or don't hear of today. But he also won an award that he had never heard of before that everybody's quite familiar with now, and that's the Heisman Trophy.
Right, which wasn't even called the Heisman Trophy that first year. But he was
right.
Excited about that free trip to New York, right?
Right.
His first time on a plane.
He got this trophy, but what really was exciting was it came with two plane tickets to New York, and he and his coach, Clark Shaughnessy, Berwanger got his very first airplane ride to go collect that Downtown Athletic Club trophy, later known as the Heisman Trophy.
Now, there are lots of stories told about the demands that he made when he was drafted to play pro football, that he demanded so much money that no team could possibly match his salary demands. But in your book, you tell a different story. You don't think he wanted to play pro ball at all.
Really, pro football was not a way for a young man to make much money, and the salary dispute, if you will, with George Halas of the Chicago Bears is really not a dispute at all. It'd be like if I would say to you, gee, I would do this interview with your charity for $1 million, whatever, you know, just to...
It was a joke.
Totally exaggerate. It was a joke. It was Berwanger's way of saying he really wasn't interested in playing pro football. Berwanger said he could make as much money giving after-dinner speeches as he could playing for the Bears, and he wouldn't get hit nearly as often.
Right. And he also wanted to compete in the Olympics, which did not happen.
Right. He had some injury problems related to football, and he struggled somewhat through his senior season of track, but still hoped that he could get in shape to try out for the Olympics. He considered dropping out of Chicago, but the administration wasn't going to hear of it. And so he stayed with his classes and came up to the final few weeks before the Olympic trials before deciding that it really wasn't going to happen, that he was going to make that 1936 Olympic team, which Jesse Owens, of course, made famous in Berlin.
Now, with your new book, and there's also a new statue of Jay Berwanger that has just been put up at a field named for his old high school football coach. Right now, he's getting quite a lot of attention. What do you think his legacy is in Dubuque?
Well, certainly it's the Heisman Trophy, and there's a lot of pride about that. But I think what makes his story special is that he was just a genuine quality individual throughout his life. He was very modest. He didn't throw his name around for business purposes or whatever to try to capitalize on his name. It would open some doors for him. There's no dispute about that. But he didn't try to waggle his way into good tables at restaurants and so on.
He was just a good and decent man.
He really was.
Well, Brian, we're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity. Appreciate it.
Brian Cooper is the author of First Heisman, The Life of Jay Berwanger, the very first winner of the Heisman Trophy. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you live or work in the Iowa City or Cedar Rapids area, there is a chance that at some point this fall, you might be running an errand and stumble across a classical music concert. Cellist Tony Arnone is an associate professor of cello at the University of Iowa. He also teaches at the Prusel School of Music in Iowa City. And for the last couple of months, he's been giving a series of solo concerts in unlikely places. He's calling it Bach to Work. Hi, Tony.
Morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here today. And tell me how this started.
Well, a couple of months ago this summer, I was up in Cedar Rapids at my car dealership getting my 30,000-mile inspection. And I had my cello with me and was kind of in the mood to play anyway because I needed to do some practice. And one of the workers walked by and said, I think jokingly, if you play a little for us, we'll take a little money off of your fee today for your car. And I ended up getting my cello out, and he found a space for me. And all these people came wandering in, a lot of the workers at the car dealership and other people waiting. And they seemed to be enjoying it very much, including this one man who I didn't get his name, but he kind of really inspired me because he was a pastor who asked if he could film me for a few minutes on his phone. He wanted to use this for a sermon that he gives on finding beauty in unexpected places. And I said, of course, feel free. And it really got me thinking when I was driving home about the beauty in unexpected places. That phrase somehow just stuck with me. And the response that people gave me and gave the cello, hearing the sound of the cello by itself, which is not so common for people to hear that. So it kind of occurred to me that it would be a really fun win-win project for, in a lot of ways, to maybe kind of do a flash mob sort of appearance at a lot of places where people run their errands, where I run my errands, where I go every day, and just set up and play cello music. And for me, the obvious choice was to do the Bach movements from the Bach suites. He wrote six suites, and I love playing all six preludes. So that's my program, which is about a half an hour. So it's not too long a program. It's not too loud. That's kind of what inspired me to get going. So I approached all these different places and, you know, first wanted to make sure I could get the okay and kind of went on from there. So
Now, certainly the idea that somebody was moved enough by what you were doing to talk about it in a sermon, I can imagine that is a pretty powerful reaction. But what were some of the other reactions that you got that made you leave that day thinking, wow, I want to do that again?
Well, just some of the other people waiting for their cars, you know, thanking me, saying it really made their day, what an unexpected treat it was, just the smiles on their faces their look of enjoyment. Just hearing the sound of the cello, I think it wasn't so much exactly what I was playing, but just hearing The sound of a solo cello. I think a lot of people don't, especially up close or live, get to do that. So that really inspired me to want to do more of it.
So where did you turn next? Where was the next place you played?
I thought it would be fitting that the first place I would, do this project would be at the Cedar Rapids Airport. People coming into town. And it actually happened to be that I was picking up a musician friend from a Tony and Friends concert that I do every fall. So I just thought, well, I'm going to go a little early, and before I get my clarinetist friend from Dallas, I'm going to play. And that was very fun to see people walking through, off their flights, coming through and having this cello music welcoming them. So that's how it began. Yeah.
There is a very famous story that it made a lot of news for a while, and it still gets passed around the internet. You see it posted on Facebook, but about Joshua Bell, the very famous violinist, and he decided to busk in the Washington, D.C. metro one day, and he stood and he played. And a lot of people take different thoughts away from that. People talk about beauty in unexpected places, but also they talk about how we rush around so much. We don't have time to stop and listen, even if a world-class violinist is playing a free concert for us. Were you inspired by that story in this thinking?
Not initially. I think initially it was just wanting to share my music. But then once this project got rolling, there's certainly an element of that too. It's kind of an experiment. In a way, it's been interesting for me to go to different venues, if you call them venues, and see how the reaction differs. I mean, I played at the dental office at the UI Dental School a couple days ago, and that was a pretty captive audience in there. But actually, I had a pretty quiet, polite audience that clapped between movements. And then the week before, I was at the Bread Garden, and that was kind of the opposite. I mean, there were some very nice people there enjoying their lunch and came nice comments, but there were also a lot of people that walked by that seemed afraid to look at me. They're just not even want to acknowledge that this elephant in the room. I'm in Bread Garden and there's a cellist playing right here. But
why do you think people have that reaction?
I wasn't sure. I thought it might have something to do with just being very close to the Ped Mall, and maybe there are other people often sitting out there that might be asking for money or something, that maybe they were in that sort of mode. And also, I didn't dress up for that concert. I was actually wearing a soccer jersey with my name on the back just for fun and some jeans. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but it was fun because I one thing I'm able to do with a lot of the Bach movements is look around and look at people. I don't use music, and for many of them, I'm very comfortable with that. Some of the others I really have to concentrate for. I can space out. But so it was fun to try and catch some of their eyes and kind of look at them and say, yes, I'm here. I'm playing.
That's interesting. I wonder if – I'm sure, of course, some people on their lunch hour, they're very busy. They're in a hurry. I wonder if they're afraid of getting pulled in.
Maybe. But, also at the Bread Garden, one of the nicest comments I got was a woman afterwards who came up and just was so thankful. She said, "I just wanted to tell you, you really made my day today. Thank you so much for doing this. It was, such a treat." And that's one of the biggest reasons why I do it.
Can you give us a sample of what you've been playing?
Sure. I'll play the prelude from the first suite, which is probably the most recognizable and probably the most sort of innocent in its temperament. And what's interesting with these preludes is that Bach wrote them all about the same time in his life. But if you didn't know that, you might think he was very young when he wrote this first one and kind of go through his lifespan. But yeah, I'll play this one for a couple minutes. The
cellist Tony Arnone giving us a sample of the kind of thing he's been doing at various businesses all over Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, pop-up solo cello concerts. Tony, when you're playing, do you find that some people will stop and actually listen to the entire performance?
Yeah, I've had a couple of those, definitely. I think one of them was at the Wellness Center. I played there and there was someone, I think, going to do his workout, but and maybe caught it somewhere in the middle, but stayed for the whole rest of it and came up and gave me a big thumbs up afterwards and thank you. And he seemed to know the music already, and he said something about thank you for helping my mental health today as opposed to the workout, the physical health. So that was very touching and nice.
Now, a lot of the places you've been playing are noisy places, like the grocery store. There's usually the Muzak playing, and mm-hmm. there are lots of people moving around. Children tend to cry uh-huh. at the grocery store.
Yes.
What is that experience like for you as a musician? I assume they turn the music off for you.
They do. They shut down the music. But there can be some other distractions happening, sometimes visual or sometimes just sound-wise. But it doesn't bother me at all. I love it. Trying to think where it was, maybe the dental office, where there was a young baby who started not crying, but just kind of making, I think, happy noises. I don't know. But I was just smiling at her and the mother. And I didn't want anyone to feel like they needed to act differently because I'm there, you know, to go on with their lives if that's what they feel like doing. And any other noises were fine. The grocery store was a little noisy, but it's been fun to just have a mix of different environments, different acoustics for my cello to sound good or not as good in. And, you know, just to be ready for anything. And I think that's so valuable for performers as well. I mean, one thing that's been inspiring for me and that I would encourage is I've had a number of friends around the country via Facebook posts and whatnot say, this is such a great project. I'm going to do this where I live. And to me, that's the other really important message that's become my sort of quest is to, you know, if we want to make change and have people enjoy classical music concerts, we have to start from where we live. And, you know, people just can't get out to hear these concerts as easily as they might have before. Everyone's busy and they often cost money, and there's so many different kind of music to pick from that I just really want to go to them and share. So I don't really care if it's, you know, crazy environment out or, you know, noisy or peaceful. I'm happy to be there doing it.
What kind of a reaction have you seen from kids?
A lot of smiles and sometimes some dancing.
You know? Nice.
So that's been great too. Yeah.
How do you think it changes the music? I mean, I know that the adrenaline of a live performance changes every performance. And being up on stage is one kind of feeling. Sitting in the Hy-Vee uh-huh. where people are rushing by you is another kind of feeling. How do you think it changes your music?
It's in a way less stressful because I've done in my younger years and even not so long ago, I've played on the street before. I think that's always a really fun thing to do. And what I've enjoyed about that experience is that I can people watch, especially if I'm playing by memory. So I think it's a great lesson to just getting used to performing. And it's not quite the concert stage, like you said. It's not that scary, like I'm going to walk out and everyone's going to clap and sit there quietly. But it is performing. And so I think it's a great sort of middle ground to just get used to that. But it is quite often for me more relaxing. If people are walking by, I can smile at them. I feel it's slightly less formal. And then I also, like I said, as the program, my program goes on, I really get into my own sort of meditative zone. And that, so I could really be anywhere and I don't even know, especially the last three suites. But so that's a nice mixture of that. Depends on the day.
Now, you mentioned people coming up to you at the end. Do people ever try to talk to you while you're playing?
A couple times, yeah. And sometimes between movements, I'm happy to, if they have a question or something, I'm happy to talk. Or some of them just give me a thumbs up or a thank you. But no one's really tried to have a long conversation. Yeah, I think they're a little too shy about that. But I'm very happy to talk to people. And I have little things that I hand out that just kind of says who I am and why I'm doing
right.
this. So, but I had one woman exclaim, I'm glad your case isn't open and you're not collecting money, which I thought was very funny too. But it's true. She's right. I mean, I'm not doing this for money. I'm doing this to share the love I have of the cello and the sound. So.
Right. But you started off talking about beauty in unexpected places. And, of course, there can be musicians who are busking and hoping for tips who are performing beautiful music. They're, of course, not forcing you to give them money. Do you think that the asking for an offering, does that change the dynamic somehow?
I think it can. And when I lived in the south of France, and quite often at some restaurants outside, musicians would play and then walk around afterwards with an open sack or something. And I think, you know, I don't mind playing for money. And if my case is open, if I'm out at a market or, you know, an open market in a fun place. But I definitely never want people to feel pressured like, you know, they have to. But I could see other people, they might be doing this for their livelihood. I mean, there are a lot of people that can make a living busking and doing that. And so that's important. I don't think there's anything wrong with making money for playing your music, definitely.
Now, clearly you want to make people smile. You want to make people feel good. But you mentioned the fact that a lot of people are not going to classical music performances. Are you hoping that this will draw some people in and maybe think, make them think, wow, I want to hear more of this?
Yes. I mean, that's to me the bottom line is that I feel like our craft is possibly slowly dying away as far as having an audience come and listen to us live. Just with technology and everything, people don't, I think, feel the need to, or the extreme excitement of going to a live concert and experiencing the cello or just this, you know, these great pieces live. And so part of what I'm doing is trying to remind people of how different it is to hear this music live. And even if I just get a couple people, one person to go to a concert, you know, this fall or something, I feel like that's worth it.
What are you taking away from this experience, do you think?
I've just been having a blast. I mean, first of all, just selfishly, I love the Bach preludes. So, and as a performer, to get to perform pieces like that many times is an incredible gift. I mean, so many students and professional musicians prepare for one concert and then they play it and they're nervous and, okay, it's done. And I get to do it so many times and try different things and see what works and what doesn't. So, I mean, that's just selfishly getting to play this music, this great music again and again. I love it. And then just kind of creating a wave of recognition with this, and having I'm actually gone into places and they'll be like, you're that cello guy. Yeah. And, you know, that's been a lot of fun to sort of be recognized for the Bach suites and,
nice.
And the sound of the cello. So that's a lot of fun, too.
I'm talking with Tony Arnone, and he has a new project he's calling Bach to Work. And he's been doing solo pop-up concerts at businesses around Iowa City and Cedar Rapids. And who knows, maybe next time you're grocery shopping or going to the library, you may run into him. How many more of these do you plan to do?
I'm not quite sure. It's all flexible, but I probably would like to do another 5 to 10. See if I can find enough places that welcome me, and but somewhere around that number, probably a total of about 15.
All right. Would you play us out today?
I would be happy to. Yes, I'll do one more.
I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Thank you.